On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome and thank you for joining us for today's educational activity entitled Optimizing Care in IBD, Evidence, Costs, and Patient Goals. This activity is brought to you by CME Outfitters, a best-in-class accredited provider of continuing education for clinicians across the globe. Today's program will be archived at www.cmeoutfitters.com. Be sure to share this link with your colleagues or team members who are not able to join us today. I also encourage you to visit the website for additional educational activities and patient resources. Our goal of today's activity is to ultimately help you improve the lives of your patients with IBD. I'm Dr. Russell Cohen. I am a professor of medicine at the Pritzker School of Medicine and director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center at the University of Chicago. I'm looking forward to our discussion today, which will focus on optimizing the care of patients with IBD and recognizing both the direct and indirect costs associated with care. You know, there's no question that the cost of biologic agents can be a financial strain on the budgets of many stakeholders involved in the care of these patients. You can see a word cloud of all of the concerns that are most important to our audience today. As clinicians, managed care directors, and specialty pharmacists, there is a need to balance the cost with adequately treating IBD to remission and mucosal healing in our patients. Specialty pharmacists play an ever-growing important role on the clinical care team, and we'll talk about strategies to optimize their role on the team, and most importantly, in the care for our patients. With me today to discuss these topics are experts, Dr. Huda Marie Kanda and Dr. Thomas Ullman. Dr. Kanda worked closely with my team at the University of Chicago, where she is the clinical coordinator in the specialty pharmacy. Welcome, Huda.
Thank you, Russ.
Dr. Ullman is chief medical officer at the Mount Sinai Doctors Faculty Practice and the senior associate dean for clinical affairs at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Welcome, Tom.
Good to be with you, Russ.
You too. So let's get started. We have two learning objectives for today's activity. The first is to recognize the medical and financial costs of inadequately treated IBD. Second, we will evaluate a top-down versus a step-up approach in treating patients with inflammatory bowel disease to achieve remission and to decrease healthcare utilization. Let's begin with a polling question to you, our audience. On the screen, you'll see the poll. The question is, what is the key to reducing overall costs for patients with IBD? Please choose one. A, control flares with a course of less expensive steroids. B, restrict the use of biologic therapy until all other avenues have been exhausted. C, induce and maintain deep remission and mucosal healing with immune modulators and or biologics. Or D, start with the 5-ASA compound and then add steroids or immune modulators as needed. Please take a minute now to respond, and we'll share your answers later in our discussion. So Huda, as a specialty care pharmacist, you're very aware of the cost of inflammatory bowel disease. Can you share some of the data with us regarding contributors to this cost?
Sure, Russ. So we know that inflammatory bowel disease ranks as one of the five most expensive GI disorders, despite having the lowest prevalence. We know that the financial burden can be as high as $31 billion. It's estimated to occur in 1.9 million physician visits and up to 200,000 hospitalizations. However, hospitalizations are only a part of the total cost of inflammatory bowel disease. We know that a third of patients with ulcerative colitis will ultimately require surgery, and up to 70% of patients with Crohn's disease will also require surgery. What we've also found is that the majority of these costs are associated with a small percentage of patients. Claims data has shown us that up to 80% of costs associated with Crohn's disease are attributed to only 28% of patients.
So Hudi, you know, you talk about costs, but not all costs are created equal or easily defined. There are direct costs, but also indirect costs. Can you help us to differentiate what is a direct versus an indirect cost in IBD and how they may be important to different stakeholders?
Sure. So for direct costs, we think of the costs associated with medications, such as our biologics. We think of costs of hospitalizations or surgeries. We think of the costs associated with office visits, laboratory testing, or any diagnostic procedures. Direct costs are really any of the health care services that end up costing a large portion of the total costs of the inflammatory bowel disease. For indirect costs, we think of things like loss of employment, we think of loss of work productivity, or loss of leisure time. We know that inflammatory bowel disease can be a chronic disease and can result in disability, reduced quality of life, and can impact family and social relationships.
You know, I think that's very important. In fact, Tom, you manage a large population of patients with inflammatory bowel disease. These indirect costs, are they really something important to the patients and to you?
Yeah, I mean, Russ, these are really the things that I think matter most to patients. Are they so sick that they're going to miss a semester of college? Are they going to have to put off applying to some graduate program? Things that interfere with their ability to advance at work, let alone attend work at times. These are really big things and often the very heartbreaking aspects of IBD care when it's not going well. I really can't emphasize enough just how central these indirect costs are to our providing care to our patients.
You know, I think that I agree with my patients' perspective too, that these are the things that matter to them the most. But it's hard when you're having a cost discussion, when you get into these softer indirect costs. Hudi, has there been any studies or have there been any studies that have actually tried to put a dollar amount or at least percentage on these indirect costs?
Yes, Russ, there have been studies that have attempted to estimate the costs associated with inflammatory bowel disease. Here you see a table presented in a systematic review where they attempted to put a dollar sign to the indirect costs associated with ulcerative colitis. For example, if you look at the Gibson et al. Study, they evaluated absenteeism or short-term disability. They were able to find that approximately $8,000 were spent per patient per year, which accounted for about 33% of the total costs of inflammatory bowel disease. You will see a range here anywhere from 9 to 33% of total costs, and this is primarily because each of these studies really looked at just a portion of indirect costs, not the total definition of what indirect costs can be.
You know, I think that's very helpful when you see that each of the different studies may have looked at a subsegment of the overall indirect costs. I know that some studies have estimated that 1/2 to 2/3 of overall costs can be indirect costs in inflammatory bowel disease. So, Tom, you know, we always talk to our patients about being in remission, and we say, well, the endoscopic pictures look like this or the biopsies look like this, but what about the impact of remission on other outcomes, employment, hospitalization, surgeries? Can you share some of the data on that?
Yeah, so we have one example here to review, which I think is quite illustrative of this story. As you know, we have these really sometimes complicated instruments that don't have a terrific role in day-to-day practice, like the Crohn's Disease Activity Index. And we use these as outcome measures in clinical trials, but you know, obviously we don't live in a world of clinical trials, though they're important. We live in the real world, and you know, we measure whether patients are in remission or not. But if you can abstract from a clinical trial, and that's what's been done here, you can see that there's really a doubling of an employment rate based on whether or not you're in clinical remission, whether you got there through a medication or placebo, and in this case these things were combined, with a 31% rate of gaining employment over this 54-week trial if you went into remission, but you only gained employment to the tune of 16% if you didn't go into remission, if you stayed with active disease. So there's a real impact here. If you're in remission, you're more likely to be able to go out and find a job than if you weren't in remission. Similarly, the same study was able to look at the other measures that you mentioned as well by way of examples, hospitalizations, surgeries, And if you spent more of your time in remission, based on the CDAI for whatever it's worth, you were much less likely to be hospitalized, much less likely to have surgery. As this figure shows, it's actually anywhere from a 3 to 4-fold difference, or as much as 5-fold in the event of surgeries, if you spent more time in remission. So huge impact, as you can see, on hospitalizations, huge impact on rates of surgery, and large impact as well on whether or not you're going to be able to go out and get a job. You were also able to look at quality of life as an outcome measure as well. And there's an instrument called the SF-36, very frequently used measure of health-related quality of life and used across multiple studies and multiple disease states. And you can break that SF-36 down into both a physical component as well as into a mental component. And there's a big difference here. In the physical component, while you don't quite achieve the general population's score for quality of life, you approach it if you're in remission, but you're really a long way away from it if you're not in remission. Similarly, on the mental component of the SF-36, you basically have about the same mental quality of life if you're in remission as the general population, but you're not there if you're not in remission. So a real big difference there as well.
So Tomek, so you've shown us that achieving remission helps patients gain employment, decrease hospitalizations, decrease surgeries, and improve, if not normalize, components of their quality of life. So it's understandable why, as we move forward, that we don't just look at what things look with a scope, but actually can show big benefits to patients. And there are other benefits also, too. I know that you've looked at colon cancer risk. That also may be decrease in patients who are really in a true remission.
Yeah, I think that these are the real tangible things that we can offer as evidence to our patients when we've otherwise demonstrated that there's benefit to being on a certain medicine, right? These real outcomes, right? You're less likely to have surgery, less likely to be hospitalized, better quality of life. You know, this is important stuff. Being in remission, remission's kind of a funky word to throw around to patients, but you know, if we can explain to them that if you don't have disease activity, all of these good things are more likely to come your way. It's a really nice thing to be able to tell them.
Right, and you know, Huda, a lot of these patients are quite young, so I think the impact of achieving remission in a younger person who has a lifetime ahead of them of employment, a lifetime of facing surgery or no surgery, hospitalizations, and quality of life and reflected on how their family and business life operate is actually also quite important to remember.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, let's go back to our polling question and see how you, the audience, responded. The question that I had asked was, what is the key to reducing overall costs for patients with IBD? 13% of you chose A, control flares with a course of less expensive steroids. 22% chose B, restrict use of biologic therapy until all other avenues have been exhausted. A little over half of you, 52%, chose C, induce and maintain deep remission and mucosal healing with immune modulators and or biologics. And 13% chose D, start with a 5-SA and add steroids or immune modulators as needed. So Tom, half the people responded said that you should use the immune modulators and biologics and half didn't. Are you surprised by these results?
I can't say that I'm entirely surprised, but I must confess to being a little bit discouraged. I think that, you know, we've been, we have the task of doing the best job of educating our community of gastroenterologists as best we can. And I think we've kind of fallen short, and I think that some of the older practice patterns and the older targets of therapy are still very in the forefront of most people's heads here, and we've got to do a better job.
Yeah, you know, you and I have lectured for many years on these therapies, and I think it's fair to say that some people in the audience have always said, well, yes, we understand that they work and they're safe, but we're very concerned about the costs, and in these days you can't ignore that. Huda, are there strategies to perhaps streamline the costs of care in IBD, which may help balance this conversation a little better?
Sure, Russ. So we need to ensure that all patients have access to treatment that is goal-oriented and effective. So in other words, we need to make sure that patients are receiving the right treatment at the right time. By ensuring this, we can avoid complications and comorbidities that may be associated with inflammatory bowel disease. By avoiding complications and comorbidities, we're avoiding high healthcare resource utilization and high healthcare costs. We also need to continue to educate our patients on the importance of adherence. By maintaining adherent to therapy, they can maintain effective therapy, maintain remission, and prevent healthcare costs.
And maintaining remission, how is that key to reducing overall costs?
So we know that there's a substantial cost associated with suboptimal therapy for both patients and for third-party payers. We need to achieve goals of therapy that include remission and mucosal healing. We know that symptoms are not always indicative of mucosal inflammation. We need to make sure that we're targeting mucosal healing to prevent chronic inflammation and the complications that can occur from chronic inflammation, such as bowel damage, abscesses, or strictures.
Well, thank you. That's actually a very helpful summary of different ways that we can keep the cost down by keeping people well and avoiding the expensive components that contribute to disease utilization and costs. So, Tom, you're a big fan of superheroes.
Yes, I am.
Yes, you are. And as you know, not all IBD patients are equal when it comes to healthcare utilization. There is a term that has been coined called super utilizers. So what are some of the factors that define a super utilizer of healthcare dollars?
Right, so we have a figure up that really demonstrates a lot of cumulative data from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Taken over 5 years from 2009 to 2013, they were able to subdivide their patient population into groups who had consistently high disease activity versus high fluctuating, low fluctuating, decreasing activity, and so on. And it turns out that 52% of the population who are consistently low utilizers, and these are the patients who, you know, show up for an occasional appointment, sometimes even prompted by a request for a refill after having not been seen for a while. And these are greater than 50% of the patients and really only constitute 4% of the costs that are there. Conversely, we have that flip side, the sort of super utilizers, as you call them, and this really represents only about 5% of patients, and they represent over 50% of the costs. These are the folks who are at a consistently high burden of inflammation. These patients are more likely to have Crohn's disease, more likely to have perianal complications, extensive disease when they have ulcerative colitis, and a higher rate of prior surgery. And this is really the group that we need to target and focus in on, really bring them into as deep a remission as we're able to, drive down their utilization consequently.
So there are these risk factors, particularly identify those who want to intervene early and effectively to help keep down overall costs to prevent them from being, as you can see in that pie chart, a consistently high or high fluctuating utilizer of healthcare resources and associated costs. So, you know, Tom, when you and I trained, things were very easy. Patient felt better. We said, good, you're better. They say, am I in remission? You're like, do you feel anything? I said, no, yeah, you're in remission. But there has been some sophistication of our science over the ensuing 20 years, and we now actually, I think, have some more objective measurements to really let us know if the patients are in remission or very much improved. What might those be?
Yeah, so the flip side of the coin really of symptom-based assessment of the patients that we take care of is really what's going on with their lining, right? What's the burden of mucosal illness at this point in time? We don't want to ignore symptoms, but that really adds onto it. And so instead of thinking purely about a clinical response on a symptom-based score, we're really trying to find out, you know, are you in a deep remission, right? Have we healed the lining as well as we might be able to or not? You know, do you have active complications of the disease? What does your scope look like? What does your imaging look like when we can do those things? And, you know, we have some rather inexpensive biomarkers that can help us to some extent, not perfect, and always improving, but, you know, these are the kinds of things we're looking for now. And so we're looking much more for a sustained disease control that's there so that we can improve their quality of life and really have them, you know, being all that they can be, if you will, And that really has become much more our target than just that sort of how you doing question. Though that's still important, doesn't tell the whole story.
So instead of just going by how someone feels, prove it. Prove they're better, whether it be by scope or by, you mentioned certain biomarkers, there's fecal calprotectins that are more and more popular, C-reactive protein, which in individuals that make CRP may be helpful. I mean, are those things that clinicians should make part of their practice?
Absolutely. I think it's really critical that we do, that we really look. It's the old Ronald Reagan, trust but verify, right? Trust that your patient, when they're doing well, really is doing well, but verify it if you can. And that flip side of patients, we all have them. We all see them all the time who have either settled or don't like to complain or don't want to disappoint you as a physician. And really won't tell you much about what's going on symptom-wise, but may not be as well as they're leading on. So it's really important that we stay on top of things, that we have as much objective evidence toward healing as possible as we try and drive patients into a better state and a better future.
And so even though you'd use Ronald Reagan quotes, you're actually moving forward with your healthcare administration.
Yes.
So. This is a good transition to our second learning objective, evaluating a top-down versus a step-up treatment approach in appropriate patients with IBD to achieve remission and to decrease healthcare utilization. Let's begin this section by asking you, the audience, another polling question. You will see the question on your screen. The question is, how confident are you in utilizing a top-down versus a step-up treatment approach in patients with moderate to severe IBD? Please choose one of the following: A, extremely confident; B, confident; C, somewhat confident; or D, really not confident at all. Please take a minute to respond, and we'll share your answers later in our discussion. I look forward to seeing your responses. So, three areas that we will address as part of the treatment strategy are treatment by location phenotype, top-down versus step-up strategies, and risk assessment strategies, which may help tie it all together. So Tom, you see patients with Crohn's disease, you see patients with ulcerative colitis. They're always asking you, which one do I have? What are the differences in the disease phenotype between patients with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis?
So, Russ, as you know, ulcerative colitis is, we largely think of as a mucosal disease only. It's just inflammation of the lining of the rectum and perhaps some element of the colon in a continuous fashion. Crohn's disease, however, because of that inflammation, can just be inflammatory, but because of that inflammation, patients are at risk for developing inflammatory strictures where they're scarring down from prior inflammation that's there. Or from other complications, and really the penetrating complications are the ones that we worry about most. The ulcers that occur in Crohn's disease and the inflammatory activity can actually burrow through the lining and get to the outside, just beyond the mucosa, and involve other adjacent organs. And so we can have fistulas around the anal canal, we can have fistulas to the bladder, fistulas to other parts of the intestine. And we also like to think about Crohn's disease, as we do in ulcerative colitis, as well in something of a real estate proposition here as well. So how much mucosa is at risk, how much isn't at risk, and where is it located in the gastrointestinal tract, particularly in Crohn's disease?
Well, Tom, it's interesting because sometimes I see patients who maybe come from New York out to Chicago to go to college, and they say to me, oh, Dr. Ullman is my doctor, and he told me that I have ulcerative colitis, but now you're telling me I have Crohn's disease. So who's right, you or me?
Well, Russ, you're generally right, and I want to be very clear about that. But, oftentimes there is this evolution that can happen that really is no evolution. We can be fooled because Crohn's disease can be purely inflammatory, the same way that ulcerative colitis is. Sometimes it's very hard to distinguish one from the other, and what we thought was ulcerative colitis can later evolve a Crohn's disease phenotype with the presence of a fistula, the presence of a stricture, as I mentioned. Or things can happen along the way that can, we can say, this is Crohn's disease. There can be different subtle changes with the presence of granulomas under the microscope. Different things can happen. Usually you're right, but occasionally, I get it right too. Patients can have had ulcerative colitis and later be found out to have Crohn's disease?
Well, to save us both, I tell the patients, you know, the immune system doesn't read the textbooks, and sometimes things do change every time when we're learning more and more about the environment and the microbiome, and that actually those transitions may be due to something that is literally in our microbiome, stimulated from our environment, and there's more to see about that.
And it's probably also worth pointing out that, you know, on a certain level, when we're talking about inflammation of the colon, because that's where they become difficult to distinguish from one another, there's not a whole lot of difference in the current environment in terms of how we treat with medicines. It may matter surgically, and some of those changes from ulcerative colitis to Crohn's disease happen after surgery, but it's not as hugely important as we otherwise might think it is.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So, Tom and Huda, let's check in on the results of the poll. As a reminder, the question was, how confident are you, the audience, in utilizing a top-down versus a step-up approach in patients with moderate to severe IBD? So 2.7%, or we'll say 3%, said they were extremely confident. 13.5% to 14% said they were confident. A little less than half, 46%, said they were somewhat confident. And 38% said they're not at all confident. So that means that over 80% were either not confident or only somewhat confident. What do you think? Is it that the audience is throwing us a curveball here?
Well, I think that there is a knowledge gap that we need to address, and we will continue to address throughout this presentation, but it's important to understand what subgroup of patients do we need to consider a top-down approach for, and that's what we'll do here in the next few slides.
Well, you know, whenever we do these questions, it is hard to know sometimes what type of response we get, but it is helpful that a lot of people aren't quite sure what to do, because we're not always quite sure what to do. But I think maybe to start us off is, Tom, why don't you just lead us through the basics about the top-down versus step-up study and strategies, and what do we learn from those?
Sure. So the initial study that really even brought this concept of top-down versus step-up therapy was published almost a decade ago now by a European group. And they took a number of patients who were at, you know, were in a bad way. They had moderate to severe disease at some point, had only had disease for 4 years or less. They randomized to two different treatment strategies. A really great study in the comparative effectiveness research kind of literature that's out there. And it was really interesting. It represented state of the art at that time. It's not quite state of the art now, but it was then. And the step-up strategy had, or the step-up arm of the study had a very protocolized strategy where you didn't just receive one course of steroids for treatment of the flare, but if you got through that flare and you still needed something, you weren't in remission, you got a second course of steroids. And only after then did you then go on to an immunomodulator arm or an immunomodulator step, which was either weight-based azathioprine or methotrexate. And then only after that did you see infliximab. And so you went through a number of steps along the way before you got to the sort of the more potent infliximab-based therapy. Top-down, completely the opposite. You started with early infliximab and a weight-based immunomodulator of azathioprine. And after that, you received episodic infliximab. So this is well before we had the ACCENT studies under our belt, and well before we knew that we had to regularly give infliximab to avoid immunogenicity and to improve outcomes as well. So you had episodic infliximab, then followed by periodic steroids if you continued to break through those episodes of requiring infliximab therapy. And so those are the two basic arms of the study. And they found out that, not surprisingly, the top-down worked. What was really cool is that after 2 years, a couple of things happened. One, because of the availability in the step-up therapy to get onto infliximab and to azathioprine, patients started to look a lot the same in terms of what therapies they were on at 2 years. But if you bothered to go ahead and do a colonoscopy on them, there was really a big difference in the two groups. The group that had the early aggressive therapy, the top-down therapy, had mucosal remission almost at a rate of 3/4, 73%, really impressive number. If you had the step-up therapy, though, your mucosal healing rate was only about 30%. And so, you know, you really had done a much better job of controlling the inflammatory burden of the disease if you went with top down.
Well, you know, I think that last point is the most powerful because, as you mentioned, even though people who were stepping up, many of them eventually did end up on the biologic at the time, which was infliximab, they still lagged far behind 2 years out at the colonoscopy, suggesting that maybe the damage had already been done. And some people have suspected that repeated steroid courses may make a patient more refractory to response to therapy as well, too.
Yeah, it's clearly, you know, our literature has clearly demonstrated that it's a tougher game the longer you delay in initiating the biologic therapies that are out there. It's been shown in a number of different trials, and it is a really important concept. We really don't want the inflammation to remain brewing for too long a period of time because you may have lost the opportunity to successfully intervene the longer you wait.
Right, and Huda, you know, as Tom pointed out, this study was done over 10 years ago. So the people who treat a lot of Crohn's and colitis, we were then saying, well, look, we have these much better outcomes, but we were kind of stymied when we would try to do a prescription for a biologic right off the bat in patients, and there was a lot of pushback from the payers. How could having a clinical pharmacist or a specialty care pharmacist like yourself in the practice maybe help bridge that gap?
Sure, Russ. So now we know the importance of outcomes such as mucosal healing and deep remission. So we can work with payers to identify a subgroup of patients that need top-down therapy versus step-up therapy. And as we get to the pathways that we'll talk about, we'll describe high-risk and low-risk patients and who really is a candidate for top-down therapy. A lot of times we as pharmacists will work with these third-party payers to ensure access to the medications that is deemed necessary for a patient.
Terrific. And I think that's a very nice segue into the pathway. So in 2014, the AGA, the American Gastroenterological Association, published the Crohn's disease care pathway to guide decisions about risk assessment and treatment. Since its development, vedolizumab has been approved by the FDA. So we're going to focus on the key points in the published pathway, but also update it to include vedolizumab, which is not included at the time of the publication. Key points of the pathway are risk assessment, induction of remission, maintenance of remission, and then clinical decision support tools. So Huda, can you walk us through the important considerations concerning risk assessment that were outlined in the Crohn's disease care pathway?
Sure, Russ. So the AGA clinical pathway for Crohn's disease, one of the earlier steps in this pathway is to evaluate a patient for being high risk or low risk. You look at different factors such as their current and their previous disease burden. For example, for a patient at age less than 30 at the time of initial diagnosis would be considered a high risk patient. Patients with extensive anatomic involvement, perianal disease, severe rectal disease, deep ulcers on endoscopy, prior surgical resection, or complications such as stricturing or penetrating disease would really categorize that patient as a moderate to high risk patient, therefore requiring a certain treatment strategy.
So Tom, with these risks in mind, a moderate to high risk Crohn's disease patient, what does the pathway tell us about inducing treatment or inducing remission? What medication should we be looking at?
Right, so you know, when we've done this assessment and we've figured out who the high risk patients are, and who did a great job of describing that, you know, these are the folks who are going to need a great maintenance strategy, but we got to get them better first before we can even consider maintenance therapy. It's been nicely demonstrated that biologic monotherapy is superior to no therapy at all or to immunomodulator monotherapy, but really that combination is probably most preferable. A combination of a biologic and an immunomodulator is more successful than an immunomodulator by itself or and a biologic by itself when that's been able to be assessed. We tend to, in addition to using the thiopurines as our immunomodulators, that's either azathioprine or its sister agent, mercaptopurine, that those generally are our preferred agents, but we'll use methotrexate in those who are intolerant to the thiopurines, and that's probably about 15% or so of the population. And the goal is to induce a robust remission, but then we got to keep them there.
Right. So Tom, as we already identify you as a superhero, you've now induced their remission. What does the pathway tell us about ways to maintain that remission?
Well, if I am a superhero and I'm really not Russ, I think I'm most like Batman because he had zero superpowers, just a really cool belt. So,
car.
And a very cool car. And Alfred, let's not forget. After we've induced remission, we need to have that really important exit strategy of what's there. If steroids have been used to induce that remission, then we want to add on an immunomodulator with or without a biologic to maintain that remission over time and really have our fingers, if we're just choosing monotherapy with an immunomodulator, according to this AGA pathway, really want to keep our finger on the trigger of the biologic that might follow as well. If they're induced with a biologic or induced with combination therapy of a biologic and an immunomodulator, we want to keep them going with a biologic with or without an immunomodulator moving forward. If we use a biologic, we want to keep using it. All of these, at least currently, are monoclonal antibodies or related to a monoclonal antibody, have a certain amount of immunogenicity associated with them. And if we leave using them or we take that medicine away, we run the risk of it not working if we come back, and it's probably too great a risk. So we want to continue these.
So Tom gave us a very nice summary of the pathway treatment. He mentioned immunomodulators, biologics. As far as the biologics, what are the current FDA-approved biologics for the treatment of moderate to severe Crohn's disease?
Sure, Russ. So we have two main classes of drugs. The first class is the anti-TNF agents. The drugs for this class are adalimumab, infliximab, and certolizumab. So these are monoclonal antibodies that target the TNF-alpha molecule, block its interaction, and prevent subsequent inflammatory cascades. The black box warnings for this drug class are serious infections, including opportunistic infections such as tuberculosis. Another black box warning for this class is the risk of malignancies such as melanoma. So it's important that patients are screened for tuberculosis and screened for hepatitis B virus prior to initiation of a TNF-alpha agent. Additionally, it's recommended that during therapy, these patients are screened yearly at a dermatologic visit for annual skin exams. Another class is the integrin inhibitors or the integrin antagonists. We think of natalizumab as an alpha 1 beta 1 beta 7 integrin antagonist. It's rarely used these days for the treatment of Crohn's disease based on the alternative options now available. But for this medication, the black box warning is the risk for PML infection, which is a rare and potentially fatal viral infection of the brain. For patients that are selected to be candidates for natalizumab, we would have to perform a JCV virus antibody test and repeat that during therapy every 6 to 12 months. The other medication is vedolizumab. That's their most recent integrin inhibitor, and it's more specific and more selective compared to natalizumab. It's selective for the gut tissue. Currently, there are no black box warnings for vedolizumab.
Right. So, thanks for making that summary, because that's quite helpful. Tom, you and I sit and maybe we're waiting for the Yankees to maybe finally make their move. Watch TV, we see commercials for the TNF. Some of the things scare our patients. Who would have listed some serious infections, opportunistic infections, melanoma risk? Are these risks high or are they very low?
Well, it's a really important question, and I think we spend probably proportionally much more time discussing these risks than we do the great benefits that are out there when we're with our patients and talking to them about the possibility of starting one of these medications. The risks are real. The risks are increased, but they are numerically quite small. We're talking about absolute risk increases in the cases of lymphoma and melanoma that are really rather small, and a few, meaning like 2 to 3 or 4 per 10,000 patients. The risks for opportunistic infections are pretty uncommon as well. Knock wood, it's been a very long time since I've had a patient with a pneumocystis pneumonia or a fungal infection that's come into my office. But we do have to keep our guard up for this. I think it's really important, though, that we stress the great benefits of these patients, of these agents, moving forward, but you know that we do this in the larger context of really discussing the risks in a way that matters, and not in the rare radio or TV commercial that I've seen where they rattle them off a mile a minute. It's important to sit, discuss it, use visual aids when we have them to go over these risks with our patients.
Right, and Huda, you know, as you mentioned, we really don't use natalizumab except for very rare occasions, but vedolizumab, we're still not aware of any risks at all unless someone's allergic to the drug. And while it just came out in May of 2014, we've been studying it for many years at our institution and others, and even a precursor drug, and really nothing has shown up. Is that reassuring to providers and to patients?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's another treatment option for patients that perhaps didn't tolerate an anti-TNF. It's a great treatment option, in consideration with other TNFs based on the patient-specific factors.
Terrific. So, similarly to the Crohn's pathway, the AGA released a care pathway for ulcerative colitis in 2015. This also is based on risk assessment, initial therapy, exacerbation treatment options, and clinical decision support tools. So Huda, you did such a nice job with the Crohn's disease pathway. Can you just go through the high risk issues that might show up according to this UC pathway?
Sure. So similar to the Crohn's clinical pathway we discussed, the ulcerative colitis clinical pathway also stratifies patients as being low or high risk. This time it's risk for colectomy. So a high-risk patient or a patient at high risk for colectomy would be someone of age 40 at the time of their initial diagnosis. Again, a patient with extensive anatomic involvement, a patient with elevated CRP and ESR, a patient that has ulcerative colitis that requires steroids for control, a patient with deep ulcers on endoscopy, and patients with C. diff or CMV infection.
So with those risks in mind, Tom, so now we've identified what the higher risk patients are. I think it's pretty similar to the Crohn's disease pathway, but in the ulcerative colitis care pathway, induction and then maintenance of remission.
Right, so very, very similar kind of background. The only key differences that are here is we're a little more lenient with the use of corticosteroids to induce a remission here than when in this high risk group. When we do induce remission with steroids, we want to start them on an immunomodulator right away. We don't want to wait for bad things to happen and allow for things to fester over time. Otherwise, it's virtually the same. A great pathway and a pathway often uses the combination therapy of an anti-TNF with thiopurine. We don't use methotrexate in ulcerative colitis the way we do in Crohn's disease because the evidence basis isn't quite there. And we can also use vedolizumab with an immunomodulator, but we have to pursue that pathway with a little bit of caution. It's not as rapidly as effective as a medication, vedolizumab isn't, as the anti-TNFs are and as corticosteroids are. But as it was with Crohn's disease, we induce remission, but the key thing here is really maintaining that remission. And our options really here are the same. You generally want to continue what you've started if it's working well. You want to continue that thiopurine, you want to continue the combination therapy of an anti-TNF with a thiopurine or vedolizumab with a thiopurine moving forward. And just keep going and don't abandon, at least not initially, until something doesn't work.
And as far as the FDA-approved agents, any differences then from what Huda told us with the ulcerative colitis than from the Crohn's table?
Yeah, just a couple of subtle differences that you'll see on this table. First of all, in the third column that's there, you'll see different acronyms describing the pivotal studies that led to approval. But you'll see certolizumab pegol is not on this list, but it's replaced by a different anti-TNF agent, which is effective in ulcerative colitis, called golimumab, to go along with the infliximab and adalimumab that were there before. Same warnings on the prescribing information that was there as before. And you don't see natalizumab anymore. So. Natalizumab has not been shown to be effective in ulcerative colitis, as Huda pointed out earlier as well. I think it's important to remember that with the JC virus story and PML, possibly fatal brain infection that's there, the other anti-integrin, vedolizumab, that is approved, which has no such association, even though the black box warning does exist for it, we've still not, since in the more than 2 years since this medication has been out, we've not seen a single IBD patient develop a PML. And so it's certainly important to recall that as well. So a couple of subtle differences, but overall the same strategies.
Right, and even in the trials dating back for years beforehand with the vedolizumab and with the precursor Millennium drug, there really was nothing at all to suggest that
too. I think the gut specificity that we described is really an important aspect of it. So it doesn't interfere with immunologic events in the CNS or elsewhere. It's really very gut specific.
Okay, so Huda, we have this whole list of medicines now ready to go. Let's spend some time now focusing on the role of the specialty or the managed care pharmacist as part of our clinical care team.
Sure, Russ. So specialty and managed care pharmacists have really become an integral part of the IBD care team. Specialty pharmacists now are strategically positioned within a healthcare system such as the University of Chicago, where they can really become part of the interdisciplinary team caring for IBD patients. Specialty pharmacists assist patients and providers in accessing drug. So a lot of times, specialty pharmacists are completing prior authorizations and really creating that bridge with third-party payers on behalf of providers and attaining authorizations for patients to pursue treatment. Additionally, another barrier that specialty pharmacists help to overcome is the out-of-pocket costs that some patients may face. So although they may achieve authorization for a medication, the cost of the medication can often be a big burden. So we work very closely with patients to enroll them in drug manufacturer programs or foundations where we can help assist patients to start therapy and really to continue therapy if the financial charges change.
So it sounds like the specialty pharmacist is a real addition to an IBD care team. Is that the feedback that you've been getting from the staff?
Yes, absolutely. We really have two main goals. The first goal is access to the medication and making sure that the patient can start the prescribed medication. On the other hand is our clinical management, our clinical involvement with patients. So we work to ensure that patients are appropriately starting therapy and appropriately screened prior to starting agents. So for example, we're screening them for baseline testing for tuberculosis or hepatitis B infection. We're also recommending vaccinations before and during therapy and what vaccinations to avoid during therapy. The most important, maybe the most direct clinical piece that we have as pharmacists is the patient education that we do. So we educate each and every one of our patients on the appropriate dosing, the dosing schedule of biologics, administration and injection techniques, and then we tell them about the adverse effects that they may experience and how to address them if they do occur.
So it sounds like the specialty pharmacy person does a lot of actions. I'll have to tell the boss to consider giving you a raise. But has there been any data showing an impact that a specialty pharmacist team might have on the medical team itself?
Sure. So specialty pharmacists work very closely with providers to ensure that the right patient is starting the right drug at the right time. And so this is shown by the University of Illinois at Chicago that performed a study to check the compliance rates with safety monitoring recommendations. So what they did was they implemented a guideline that recommended the screening of tuberculosis, hepatitis B, LFTs and CBC prior to initiation of a biologic response modifier. What they found is that before the guidelines were implemented, the compliance rate was only 31%. After these guidelines were implemented, that compliance rate increased to 60%, nearly doubled. So therefore, strategically working with a specialty pharmacist can really improve patient safety and help physicians meet monitoring parameters.
You're at the University of Chicago now, and as a little bit of history, a number of years ago, a young investigator named Susie Kane did an adherence study among our patients who we assumed were taking their medicines, and it turned out she proved to us that they weren't. Have there been any studies looking at the impact of a specialty pharmacist upon patient adherence with their prescribed medications?
Sure, Russ. So another study also done at the University of Chicago showed that over a 5-year span, they were able to maintain medication possession ratios above 90%. So a medication possession ratio is a measure for adherence to a medication. The industry standard and the industry reported benchmark is approximately 80%. So we're showing here that with involvement of a specialty pharmacist in a patient's care, we're able to exceed the industry benchmark of 80% and reach medication possession ratios closer to 90% for our patients. It's important to realize that, you know, if patients aren't adherent to therapy, they're not going to, you know, receive effective treatment, and they're not going to maintain their remission, and then ultimately are going to result to be high utilizers of healthcare resources.
Well, that study from the University of Illinois at Chicago was very interesting. Tom, mm-hmm. Is medication adherence a problem?
Absolutely. I'd love to say that if Dr. Kane had done her study at Mount Sinai, we would somehow miraculously see 90 and 95% medication adherence, but I suspect that it would be similarly low. The medications, not surprisingly, they only work when our patients take them. It really is critical for us to do some element of improving adherence however we can, and the clinical pharmacist pathway of doing that clearly is a very encouraging step forward.
You know, we've been talking a lot about different medications and trends, and I think it would be really a disservice if we didn't mention this incoming tide of the monoclonal biosimilars. While biosimilars have been on the market, the monoclonal have not until just recently. So, Tom, what's going on in the IBD world about biosimilars as far as the monoclonal antibodies?
Right. So, this is the new world, and we're looking forward to seeing what impact biosimilars will have, hopefully a beneficial one, that's out there. Food and Drug Administration, as you're probably aware, and our audience should be aware now, approved in April a biosimilar to infliximab, and it's approved across all of infliximab's label, so Crohn's and colitis, as well as other indications that are out there. But it's still unknown when they'll launch. It's unknown what the pricing is going to be, what impact that'll have in overall pricing in the marketplace for all biologic agents. Clearly I would suspect a number of biosimilars to come, not just this one, but we'll see a bunch more enter the marketplace, I think, in the coming years. So a lot to be determined. We don't know what the impacts are going to be. But it'll be interesting to follow, and I think I suspect it'll be a benefit to our patients over time.
Right. I mean, I think it is hard to know what the impact will be, as you said, because our country's economics and as far as the medical care is a lot different than other places. Do you do a lot of patient education around medications? Do you anticipate there being concern from the patient side if something's being switched out on them?
Absolutely. It's going to require, you know, patient education, you know, letting them know that there are studies that are being done that show encouraging data that, you know, these are biosimilar to the parent medication. And so there's going to be a lot of education opportunities, and then education opportunities regarding how third-party payers decide to place these biosimilars in their, you know, treatment algorithms.
Yes, I think it's certainly a story that is just beginning to unfold, and the intricacies of the U.S. healthcare system are ones that are unparalleled elsewhere in the world, and may have different interesting outcomes that remains mm-hmm. to be seen. So, Tom, as you're now going back to your practice in New York, we heard a lot about different approaches to treating patients. We were aware that the audience was a little uncertain about earlier use of effective agents for their patients. And what would you say to your patients you see next? And you said, and by the way, I was on this great show lately who wants to start a therapy for, let's say, for example, ulcerative colitis, moderate to severe ulcerative colitis.
Yeah, I must say that all sorts of curves have been drawn to demonstrate, you know, who the early adopters are, and, you know, who comes next, and who the late adopters are. I'd like to see us pick up all of those late adopters so that everybody has the same facility in using these medications as possible. I'm incredibly encouraged by having, you know, what a clinical pharmacist can and can't do. Our practice doesn't have one. We have healthcare we have mental health professionals, we have nutritionists, we have social workers, we have all sorts of folks. But I'm gonna contact others and get a business plan going for a clinical pharmacist.
She's not available.
We'll see if we can get Huda to move to New York. Come see the shows. Come for a weekend. You'll never go back. But I tend to think that the landscape is very encouraging. I think as we have been able to dive a little more deeply into this whole concept of mucosal healing, I think we have the opportunity to improve the outcomes and the lives of our patients. We haven't done as great a job as we'd like to. I know I personally haven't done as well a job as I'd like to. But I'm very encouraged about what we're going to be able to do moving forward. And I think you've done a great job of moderating all sorts of concepts here, Russ, that I think are going to prove to be very helpful to our patients.
Well, thanks, Tom. I think it'd be helpful to have me now summarize kind of the key clinical connections or takeaways from our presentation today. Now, while the drugs are expensive, as you mentioned, the burden of IBD is substantial. There's high direct costs, and there's high indirect costs that are associated with quality of life. IBD remission is essential to really cutting back on utilization of healthcare resources, disease burden, and associated costs. We reviewed today the AGA clinical pathways in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, both which say if you identify patients with moderate to high risk, you should be inducing and maintaining remission with immune modulators and or biologics, perhaps more so the biologics than the sicker ones or earlier, but certainly together is the most effective option and not just relying on other therapies that are ineffective. Huda has proven to us the specialty pharmacists have a very important and emerging role in the IBD or clinical care team, bridge to reimbursement, improve medication adherence, improve adherence with the medical staff of screening their patients prior to starting biologics, and of course, patient education, but foremost, patient safety. And as we move forward into this new world of other therapies and potential biosimilars, the alignment of the different stakeholders with a goal of improving patient outcomes and lowering costs. So stay with us, and we will be right back to take your questions and address your most challenging cases. I also want to encourage you to please visit www.cmeoutfitters.com for a comprehensive list of CME activities, clinical resources, outcomes research news, and much more. Okay, so welcome back. We're now going to be answering your questions hopefully were stimulated by the content of our program. So Tom, we talked about assessing patients for a hopeful mucosal healing remission with a colonoscopy at some point after therapy. What would be an appropriate time to do a colonoscopy after starting an agent such as vedolizumab?
Right, so, and perhaps we overstated a little bit. I think that mucosal healing can be assessed in a number of different ways, and I thought you did a great job, Russ, of describing some of the biomarkers that we have out there. CRP, for those who make it, and not everyone does, as you pointed out. Sedimentation rate in our patients with ulcerative colitis, certainly, and looking at some of the fecal biomarkers as well, fecal calprotectin being the best of those, probably our best in class. We don't always do a colonoscopy in every patient who we start vedolizumab in. In our patients with ulcerative colitis, it's very, very easy to actually just do a sigmoidoscopy to assess, and some nice data came out of a couple of studies recently that demonstrated that there's really not much of a difference between what goes on in the left colon and the right. So a sigmoidoscopy is often appropriate. And I think, in the case of a biologic therapy in ulcerative colitis, I tend to want to look sometime between 8 and 16 weeks. We're following symptoms along with, we're following these biomarkers and other tests that are there that can be supportive, including things like, simple things like hemoglobin that can be there. In patients with Crohn's disease, if their colon is involved, particularly the left side of their colon, I'll have a very similar strategy in terms of the timing and the test, the sigmoidoscopy. But a full colonoscopy, I may or may not do. I would talk to patients about that before starting them. But the timing of it, if it were to be done, again, sometime between about 8 and 16 weeks, I think, is the appropriate interval for the anti-TNFs as well as for vedolizumab. Give a little more time for vedolizumab.
So at the University of Chicago, what we're doing is, if you need to do a scope sooner to make decisions, you can, but we're actually scoping everyone in 6 months on vedolizumab, and we're hopefully be publishing our results soon, especially if the reviewers for the manuscript are watching this broadcast. So, Huda, one or more of the people asked questions about the compliance. They said, how do you know if the patient's taking their medicine in these studies? Do they just ask the patients? Do they call the pharmacy? What are some of the ways that they can do that?
Sure, that's a great question. So having an integrated specialty pharmacy service within a healthcare system such as the University of Chicago really helps. So we are not only providing our services to the IBD center, services helping with drug procurement and clinical management of patients, but we're also dispensing medications to our own patients. And so by having that piece and being able to dispense to our own patients, we're very closely monitoring their refills, and very proactively reaching out to our patients for refills 7 days prior to them running out. So we're able to look in our outpatient dispensing pharmacy system and look at, the drug dispense, the day's supply that it was dispensed for, and the time period, and calculate things such as a medication possession ratio, which can tell us, how many days did the patient actually have medication over, in a certain time frame. And so by having that piece in addition, to the services that we provide the clinic, we're really able to keep a close eye on our patients and to proactively promote medication adherence. And just to expand a bit on that, the types of things we do as specialty pharmacists is we call them 7 days before they run out of their medication, and we assess how much drug they have on hand and how much drug we expect them to have on hand. So if I expect that the patient is down to one shot, but they tell me that they have three shots remaining in their fridge, that's a red flag for further evaluation and maybe identifying a barrier to their adherence.
Well, that's a very good point you bring up. I mean, the older studies that Susie did, we actually called the pharmacy. The patient, it was a CME, approved study through IRRB. The patients knew that we were calling their pharmacies, and they still weren't taking their medicines. And then what Susie showed very nicely is those patients who then started taking their medicine, she did a follow-up 6 months later, went into remission, and those who still weren't taking their medicines didn't. Mm-hmm. So while we initially complained about needing to tell the patients, it turned out to give even a better study. So Tom, there's a lot of questions about when do you get your patients off of steroids? How long do you keep them on the steroids? When do you wean them off? Are there 1 month, 2 months, 6 months?
Yeah, it's sort of, it's an interesting thing that, and these are really great questions because there's really no data-driven answer that's out there. So I can only tell you what I do. And the goal is obviously to minimize total corticosteroid exposure for all the myriad potential adverse events that can happen on corticosteroids. I tend to start at doses when I use it, which I try not to. I tend to start at doses of 40 milligrams equivalent of prednisone, and I tend to use prednisone. I tend to give it in divided doses. I tend to keep them there for a week or two. Then I come down by 10 milligrams per week. I try not to use things like 10 days or other things. Just, Wednesday's your drop day. Keep it very simple. So I go from 40 a day in divided doses to 30 a day in divided doses. After 2 weeks, and then week by week, it's another drop, and the drops go 40, 30, 20, 15, 10, 5, sayonara. And I try to keep it simple like that. It doesn't always work, and sometimes there's a bit of a stumble that can happen where patients declare themselves as somewhat steroid dependent, then we really try and optimize the other medicines that we have there for maintenance therapy and as part of induction. But that's generally the strategy that I use.
Okay, and I appreciate your wealth of languages that you displayed in your
complicated stuff.
Yes, very much so. So Huda, actually a question came in from a pharmacist said that they're unclear if you use a biologic and get someone better, let's say put them in remission, then why would you keep on using the drug?
Great, so patients have to continue to use their biologic therapies to maintain that remission. So if they get off of their medication, they can have a relapse of symptoms and disease reoccurrence. So it's important that they continue the medication to maintain their remission and maintain effective treatment.
Right. In fact, even Tom, there was a study where they looked at patients who were on not just, it turns out, infliximab, but also on an azathioprine, who went into remission, and then they, in this one study, they withdrew the infliximab, and the relapse rates were quite high. That you know has been a big talk. Clearly, over half the patients relapsed, and I think that the patients that they felt that you could possibly get away were only those who were in the deepest of remission, but. Even so, a vast majority of them relapse. So do you, as a norm, stop biologics in people who get better?
As a norm, no. I mean, listen, there are always reasons to stop and failure to respond or to get into that remission to begin with is the most obvious reason to stop. But I like to keep the best medicine going for as long as the patient, and I agree that it's going to be useful. If given the choice of withdrawing one or the other medication, and we go through the pros and cons of said strategy, you definitely want to get rid of the weaker medication when two are on board. I tend to keep things going when we have the discussion about starting a medication. We have the initial discussion about under what circumstances we would stop or consider stopping. And there are some data that are out there from the STORY trial, as you're aware, that give some inkling of who is most likely to do okay if we withdraw, and what the recapture rate is if you bring that medication back on board. But I tend not to like to withdraw. I tend to like to continue. I think it's an important thing to keep them in as durable a remission as possible. There seems to be no safety concerns when we do continue.
Right. I think people ask these questions primarily for cost reasons. They say, well, the medicine costs so much and you're going to keep on doing it. But the other half to your presentation today is you show what happens when patients gain remission. When patients gain remission, they gain employment, they decrease hospitalizations, they decrease surgeries, they improve quality of life to near normal in some cases. But the other half that we didn't show is when they lose remission, patients lose employment, they get more hospitalizations, more surgeries, more emergency room visits. They utilize healthcare resources much more, which also there's higher rates of disability. And I think it's important, a lot of these patients are very young. So it's one thing to have a person go on disability perhaps in the last few years of their employable life because of a medical condition. But our patients are going on disability in their 20s. And they have a whole lifetime of earning potential in front of them where they'd be paying into the system, but instead they're on disability taking out of the system too. Mm-hmm. So I find it frustrating when people talk about the cost of medicine but don't look at the overall cost, and in America at least that's what we pay for. We pay for the overall cost mm-hmm. of care of these patients.
Absolutely, or you don't want to look at the immediate impact that medications may cause for a budget, but rather the long-term impact that it can have and the long-term costs that it could be associated with, not just the immediate impact of the cost of medications.
So Tom, one of the issues that also came about was safety, and there was a question about skin cancer risk. Who do you tell which patients do you tell to see a dermatologist, and how often?
I think that a case can be made for annual visits for patients who are on anti-TNFs. And a case can be made also for annual visits for patients on thiopurines. We didn't get to this at all, but the thiopurines have a pretty strong association with non-melanoma skin cancers. These are real frequent things, and sometimes I don't want to say we trivialize them, but we don't think of them with the same mindset as we think of melanoma. But these are a big deal, and I think having a go-to dermatologist or dermatology group is probably an important aspect of having a solid IBD center or IBD program in your practice. And so it's annual visits.
Another thing, Huda, about patient education with our Crohn's disease patients is studies have shown that over half of Crohn's patients are smokers. And smoking leads to more refractory Crohn's disease. If they have surgery, the Crohn's disease comes back faster and more reliably after surgery. They have more difficult refractory perianal disease. But we have a lot of young patients who, for social reasons, want to smoke. Are there any ways that we can maybe educate the patients better than we're currently doing about the smoking cessation in Crohn's disease?
Sure. So we could definitely educate them on the risks of smoking with Crohn's disease and the risk for relapse and progression of disease. You know, there's also the opportunity of potentially integrating smoking cessation, you know, pharmacists assessing patients for readiness to quit smoking, and maybe assessing them for appropriate treatment options if necessary to stop smoking. So that's definitely an opportunity for pharmacists to get involved, for, you know, to work with providers, but to help achieve, you know, smoking cessation for patients, because we know it's a risk factor, and you know, it's one of those things that we need to control better.
Okay, so Dr. Ullman, what about the ulcerative colitis patients who stopped smoking and got ulcerative colitis? Fascinating, huh?
Boy, yeah, no, this is really...
Another language.
Yes, yeah, I'm trying to keep it going here for you. You know, this is really a, you know, this is a bit of a challenge. You know, all of the things that we said about smoking in Crohn's disease are more than true, and we have to make every effort we can to assess readiness and to try to get them to quit. Oh, and by the way, it's bad for your heart and lungs and some other things too. But you know, these ulcerative colitis patients who stop smoking and then develop or manifest the disease, you know, this is a particularly challenging group of patients. A number of studies have looked at nicotine, which really is believed to be, because of its effect on the vascular status, you know, really seems to be the active agent as it relates to colitis symptoms. It was looked at as a potential trial, nicotine patches, but it turns out that the never smokers couldn't handle the nicotine, and so those trials didn't work out so well. I will offer sometimes a nicotine patch, but I think the overall health benefits of stopping smoking greatly outweigh what we can do in treating them. So I try to treat through, please, please, please don't go back to smoking cigarettes. Bad for your health, bad for your family's health, bad for everything.
Okay, so Huda, we actually had some great interest in the role of that you play, or that others like you might play, as a clinical pharmacist, a specialty care pharmacist. Have you, or should you, be involved in the actual decision that a patient makes when they have a few different options? The patient is told you can take one of these four, let's say, biologics. Where do you fit in?
Sure, absolutely. So we can help patients better understand some of the differences among the TNF agents. We know that from an efficacy and safety standpoint, they're pretty similar across the board. But we can work with patients that may have preferences for the dosage form, preferences for frequency of administration. So there's some details, you know, that are different among the different agents that we can work with patients, explain treatment options, and find one that's going to fit their lifestyle the best. So I think it's a great area for providers and pharmacists to work closely together to make, you know, a decision on effective treatment, but also the right treatment for a patient.
Right. Absolutely. I think that it's very helpful also patients hear from different angles. There's lots of things that they might ask you that they wouldn't ask me, or God forbid, ask Tom, who might answer in a different language. So, Tom, this next question actually came from someone who probably has been practicing a while in treating inflammatory bowel disease. They said they have a patient with ulcerative colitis who is treated with an anti-TNF agent, and it does, they do not seem to respond at all. They did a blood test. They actually have adequate drug level. They have no antibodies. They've been on 4 months of therapy. They do not have C. diff or CMV or any infection in the stool. They've scoped them. They still have moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. They've even increased the dose of the TNF to no avail despite having good levels. Is this someone who you should switch within class to a different TNF, or should you switch to a different class, in this case, vedolizumab?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, this is someone who hasn't responded to adequately dosed, as measured by levels, anti-TNF. You know, you gotta cut bait on the TNF that you're giving, and probably, and certainly, I would think, on the TNF or the anti-TNF as a class. I think that this is a good time to bring in vedolizumab. It's a good time to think about clinical trial if vedolizumab should not work. We have to remember that these medicines, while they are effective, they are not effective in everybody. You know, the huge gap that exists between response and remission levels out of 100%, it's just too great. These medicines are wonderful, and they do great things for our patients, but not in all of our patients. We have to recognize this going in. Just as it's important to have a maintenance strategy, it's, you know, as a form of an exit strategy, there also has to be that exit strategy of what are we going to do if it doesn't work. And you know, this clinician has done, you know, all of the optimizing kinds of things of checking levels, bumping up the dose, and so on, but to no avail. You know, it's not going to help the patient to continue on that agent. You've got a medicine out of that class that's effective, although not in everybody in ulcerative colitis. I think it's time to bring that one on board.
Well, but did the clinical trials with vedolizumab include a population of patients who were not responding to a TNF agent?
Yeah, and they did okay. They responded nicely. You know, not as well as those who were naive to both. But this is a group that does fine. It works a different. You know, the mechanism is totally different, and there, you know, one can have a reasonable expectation that it'll be effective.
So as we get more and more agents introduced into the marketplace with different pathways, can you envision a world where maybe even with pharmacogenomic testing or some other type of testing, we may actually be able to customize the initial biologic based on a patient profile, and then if it turns out that they truly show they're not responding to that class, be able to switch to another class?
Yeah, I think that is the future. We haven't gotten there yet. I mean, it's a pity on a certain level that we can't identify these kinds of things a priori in 2016. But we will eventually be able to get there, and we'll be able to match, drug or class of drug to a patient.
Okay, terrific. So, Huda, as we mentioned, a lot of our patients are pretty young. IBD is a disease of childhood. Some of the agents actually have an FDA indication in pediatrics. Should we be concerned about using agents let's say, teenagers who might be seen by a pediatric or adult gastroenterologist with the biologics, with the monoclonals? Is there a big concern with that age group?
I would say no. You know, we know that there's a couple of the TNF agents are approved for the, you know, pediatric population. So we think of infliximab and adalimumab now, more recently, are approved for that pediatric population. You know, what I'm more concerned about is the selection of the drug that we make and what's their lifestyle. You know, are they going away to college? Are they going to be, you know, drinking in college? And are we selecting the right therapy, the safe therapy for them, you know, and based on their lifestyle and kind of where they are in that time of their life?
Right. I agree. I have never found there to be any agent that we use at all in inflammatory bowel disease that we couldn't use in the different age groups. I mean, with some of the oral agents, it's an issue of the person swallowing the pills. We have that with some adults. But Tom, have you had any major concerns with any of the agents about the age groups?
Yeah, I want to echo what Huda said, and I think that, you know, that it's a real, the sensible approach, you know, is to give these patients give pediatric patients the same chance for getting better with these agents as we do adults. Obviously, these are diseases of a lifetime, and as I had said earlier in the program, you know, we think of administering these medicines in big chunks of time. It's not a come on and come off kind of medication, and we have to have our eyes always on the safety literature as it develops over time. But Kids are patients too, and we need to treat accordingly. We're blessed, I'm blessed, to work alongside some really outstanding pediatric gastroenterologists who are really facile in treating these patients. I think that going to college really does present, you know, a real interesting set of challenges for these patients, and it can be a big challenge to get your medicine into yourself on time. When you're away at college, attending class at times was a challenge for me, which is a much easier deal. So we have to be mindful of that, but we certainly wouldn't want to keep these medicines away, particularly when they have FDA approval.
All right. So Huda, there's actually been great interest in you and your position. One of the, or at least one of the people wrote a question asking about What is your role if, let's say, since we are at the same institution, I prescribe a injectable anti-TNF agent for a patient with ulcerative colitis, and it comes back as being denied? What do you do at that point?
Sure. So at that point, we are considering the next steps. So we are working directly with the third-party payers on behalf of the physicians and checking to see what other options we have. So a lot of times, that's moving on to the appeal stage. So if the appeal stage is a peer-to-peer review, then we're coordinating with the insurance company a time for myself and the provider to call to the insurance company and complete a peer-to-peer review, where we're discussing the patient and the case and kind of making our statement of why we think that this therapy is necessary for our patient. If a written appeal is an option, then the specialty pharmacists are also submitting letters of medical necessity. So this is a letter drafted that's specific to the patient and the patient's case, better explaining why we think that this is the medication that a patient needs. So really, we are handling everything regarding access to the medication, from submitting prior authorizations to following up on appeal statuses to requesting peer-to-peer reviews. And then if at the point where it's been denied, at the prior authorization level and an appeal level, then we're pursuing free drug programs with drug manufacturers on behalf of the providers, and for our patients. So we're taking step by step to ensure that the patient ultimately receives the drug that they're prescribed.
Right, and one of the things that, because you and I have a meeting planned coming up in the future, where you kind of bragging about how since you joined our team, we don't get too many rejections. What type of packet do you initially submit? Do you just say we want the drug, or do you send any information in to the insurers?
Sure, so we submit a very comprehensive packet. So we're submitting not only the authorization forms that the insurance is requiring, but we're also submitting medical necessity letters, especially in the situation if we're using non-FDA or non-indicated medications. So we're submitting kind of a whole packet of the specific insurers' forms that are required, but also medical necessity letters, chart notes, labs, results of different testing. So we're submitting a full packet to increase our chances of approval at the first stage.
Do you ever submit clinical trial data?
Absolutely, yes. Clinical trial data as well. So phase two, phase three trials to show that, this medication that we're selecting is safe and effective for the patient.
Terrific.
We sure we can't convince you to move to New York.
I tell you, I have her handcuffed to me by our ankles. So Tom, I had given the example of patients switching to vedolizumab after being started on a TNF, but can you use vedolizumab first line in these patients?
Absolutely. While sometimes it can be a challenge convincing an insurance company to do so, that seems to have lessened recently as well. But patients have reasons for not being on an anti-TNF in whom it's not appropriate for them. Obviously, patients with compromised tuberculosis status, hepatitis B status, legitimate fears that all the discussion in the world can't change. These are all potential reasons, and there was even a cost-effectiveness study that was presented this year at DDW, for whatever that's worth. Exactly where we position vedolizumab is unclear. As an example, I wonder where it ought to be positioned in the treatment of ulcerative colitis. I do think, for what it's worth, that the anti-TNFs are probably superior drugs in the treatment of Crohn's disease, though we have no head-to-head trial basis that's out there. And we'll see over time how it all shakes out, and we'll be able to learn retrospectively, looking at large database claims and seeing what happens to those patients, and maybe even we'll get a comparative effectiveness trial out there. And I think one is underway, though it hasn't enrolled yet.
Well, despite all these questions I have in front of me, we're out of time. I want to thank both my co-faculty here. First, of course, Huda Khanda, Dr. Khanda at the University of Chicago, and second, Dr. Tom Ullman at Mount Sinai in New York, but you're not moving to New York. And I'd like to thank the audience, for joining us here and sticking with us for this after show questions. I'm sorry I couldn't get to all your questions. There are really some excellent ones here. I'd also like to thank the CME Outfitters, who once again have helped us produce an outstanding educational program It's CME approved, and they'll actually, if you go to the website, you'll be able to find out more information about this program as well as other programs that they offer. As far as the studio here and all the staff, thank you all for joining us and making today an exceptional program. Thank you very much for joining us.